Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Today on The Grave Talks, Digging into the Dead, a conversation with Nolan Emerson. The idea of ghost hunting in high school would often end with screams, frantic calls to run, and a large cup of coffee and breakfast food, not necessarily an actual paranormal encounter. For Nolan Emerson, he can check the first three boxes and having a real encounter as well. This encounter would lead him on the way to making investigating the paranormal one of his life's goals. And it would lead him to many famous and residential hauntings as well, including The Conjuring House. Today, we hear his story on The Grave Talks.
Well, that's interesting because from an early age, I'd say probably around 4 or 5, I always just gravitated towards the, you know, spooky, strange, dark stuff. Like from 4 years old, 5 years old, I was watching Nightmare on Elm Street and Chucky and Scream and all these type of movies. In fact, one of my funniest early memories is I was 5 years old and my mom walked in on me watching The Bride of Chucky. Mm-hmm. And it was the, of all times, the sex scene in that movie. So that's just something she jokes about with me all the time to this day. So I guess from an early age, it was just, I don't know what it was. I don't know what that fascination with the spooky stuff was. Mm-hmm. Growing up at my grandpa's house, where I'm actually, that's where I am right now. We would notice that when families got together, when we had a gathering at the house, there was some strange things that would happen. And we took that to mean that it was, you know, a family member that was here to join in our festivities or something like that. The piano at my grandpa's house would play by itself. TVs would turn on and off. And I remember one time specifically, me and my brother were outside on the street right in front of my grandpa's driveway playing catch with a baseball. And he flung one way over my head, disappeared into the ditch, and we couldn't find it. We looked for it for 20 minutes to a half hour. We said, screw it. We gave up, went back inside. And an hour or so later, we heard a big thump and a roll across the second floor. When we were on the first floor, we went up there, and there was the baseball. So that's my earliest paranormal experience memories. And it wasn't until I got into probably 11, 12 years old that it started being specific towards the paranormal. So ghost hunters and ghost adventures and shows like that, they always really intrigued me. And that led to me and some friends at 16, you know, doing the stereotypical Ouija board and haunted cemeteries and things like that. So really, it was just kind of a culmination of things throughout my life that just led me to where I am right now.
Tell me about when you were younger, you know, preteens, and these sort of things were happening at like a family gathering at your grandpa's house. Does the family just kind of openly everyone accept, you know, like, oh, maybe it is, you know, so-and-so that's showing up? Is it kind of joking? Is it kind of serious? Is it kind of, you know, joking, but, you know, we believe that this is probably what it is. What was the outlook in the atmosphere?
So it's kind of split. My mom has always been very open about that stuff. In fact, she has a near-death experience that she's really open about. But my grandpa, you know, and my grandma at the time, she was still alive, they were much more kind of old school in, it's just your mind, it's all, you know, that kind of stuff. My brother was very closed off to it. He's always been the total opposite of me when it comes to the scary stuff. So it was really just me and my mom, and we live on those memories. We talk about them pretty frequently. So really, it was just my mom and a couple of other family members and my friends that would be really open about this stuff. And that's who I would confide in about these. And it was never scary, these events, because we were always all together, you know, and we're just like, oh, kind of joking, laughing and looking at each other like that was weird. And then I guess they just became memories and they still live on to this day.
That's fun. Tell me more about, you have these experiences as a teen. You decide to do the teen thing of let's go ghost hunting. And, you know, when you're in that age range, it's not exactly professional yet in many cases, unless you're out there with another group or something. But, you know, we've all, at least most of us who are probably listening to this show, have done that a time or two.
Right.
I mean, and tell me about, you know, because a lot of times when you're out there doing that, absolutely nothing happens, or it ends up being, you know, part of the group gets extremely scared and screams and everybody runs, and then it's chaos. And it was like, well, what was this? What was that? And it was like a frog or something. What did you have anything in those years of, you know, kind of having fun with that, that you would look back on and chalk up to? Maybe this was a paranormal experience, or was it like for many of us just, you know, teens having fun getting spooked out?
Well, it's funny because the first time me and my friends ever went out and actually did this, it was at a cemetery probably about 30 minutes away from where I live. And we had an Ouija board, and we just decided one night, you know, we've heard so many stories about this cemetery and let's just go. And, you know, we'll be like those guys on Go. We'll be like Zach Bagans, or we'll be like somebody on TV, you know? And we go up there and we have the Ouija board. And at this cemetery, you have to walk up a long path kind of before you actually hit any gravestones. And it's very small. And I'd say there's maybe 30 max gravestones. A lot of them are very old. A lot of them have been desecrated by dumb teenagers who go there and party and things like that, which I felt is the reason why there was some spirits there, looking back on it, why there was so much unrest at the time. But we went there, we were there for like an hour, nothing was really happening besides, you know, those random sounds in the woods that you would hear. And of course, 16 years old, we're freaked out by those. Mm-hmm. We're all alone in the back of the cemetery, and there's a gigantic white cross that sits near the end of the cemetery. And they say, you know, you're supposed to lean up against it or touch it and things will happen. So I guess I was nuts from the very beginning, because my idea was, okay, we have the Ouija board, one other person get on the planchette, I'm going to be on the other side of the planchette, and I will be leaning up against the cross. So we're, you know, trying to, early stage, we have no idea what the hell we're doing.
You're doing the teenage stuff of let's, who cares, caution to the wind.
Right, exactly. And for a couple minutes the planchette's not moving. We're, you know, kind of like, all right, so maybe this was a failed trip and we'll leave. But before we do that, my one friend who wasn't on the planchette, he goes, is there a lady here who likes to chase people out? Because that's one of the notorious stories of the cemetery, that a woman in a gown will come and chase you out one way or another. And as soon as he asked that, I started to feel really sick, like a feeling I hadn't felt before. It was really strange. And then just this blood-curdling female scream came from right in front of the cemetery. So it wasn't like an echo through the woods. Like, it was directed at us, and it was within 20, 30 feet of us. And we did the, let's get the hell out of here. We grabbed it. We ran fast on a dead sprint back to the car, and we got out of there. And we actually, I don't think we still have it, but we had that caught on audio too, on a phone recording. But that was my first time ever, like, truly going out and seeking it out. And I do feel, even looking back on it, I don't think it was anything in the woods. I don't think it was anybody in messing with us, because it was very remote. But I feel like that lady came through on command and chased us out of there.
What was your reaction immediately after. I mean, the, you know, retrospectively looking at things, you can, you know, you kind of get a little more clarity sometimes. But as you got out of there that night, you know, you're, you know, here's what I would have been at, like going to like the Country Kitchen or the Perkins or whatever, you know. And
we went to a pizza joint. We went to a pizza joint immediately.
There you go. Yeah. So, you know, you're sitting there late at night and hanging out. What's that conversation like?
We were really just spitballing back and forth. We were playing the recording over and over again because you could hear just a clear scream through his phone audio. And we're like, well, you know, trying to break it down. What could that have been? You know, was that somebody just trying to scare us? But this cemetery is so remote and back that you could see cars coming from and hear a car coming from, you know, 2 miles away. Mm-hmm. And there's nobody out here with us. We're trying to figure out, and we're like, oh, we need to go back. Let's go back. So after we got done eating, it was like, you know, late at night at this point, we go back, but there's a whole other big group there. Excuse me. Whole other big group there. And, you know, when 40 people are in a cemetery, it kind of kills the vibe. And So I've actually never been back there to my recollection since then.
But everybody really felt at that moment. It wasn't, you had nothing to debunk it with, essentially.
Yeah, we tried. We had nothing that we could think of rationally that could debunk what we heard, that we all heard at the same time. And we were all terrified, of course. So, you know, being 16, 17 in that, you know, it's hard to think clearly in that moment. But even looking back on it now, after I've done this for, you know, 4 or 5 years, I really don't have an explanation for that.
So obviously that was a compelling moment for you. How did mm-hmm. things continue after that with your interest in ghost hunting?
Well, that's, in fact, not too long after that, I was, you know, me and my friends, we were all talking about it because, like, this was a big, big event for us. For most of my friends group, that was the first thing that's ever happened to them of that nature. And like I said, I've had a few mini weird things happen to me in my childhood, but that was the most concrete one, you know, at that point. Mm-hmm. So we started again, 16, 17 at this point still. A little later on came the most impactful experience, even to this day, that I've ever had. So I need to give a little backstory for this one.
Okay.
There was a kid we went to school with. I'm not going to say his name, but I'll tell you his initials later because that comes in.
Okay.
There was a kid at school that me and my friend Jared, we would talk to, we weren't really friends with, but he was kind of somebody, he was, I don't want to say an outcast, but he was, you know, a strange kid. Mm-hmm. And we always, you would just talk to him and he'd sit with us at, you know, study hall and school and things like that. And we've hung out with him a couple times, but he was not somebody who we associated with or talked about outside school very much. Mm-hmm. So one night again on the Ouija board, me, Jared, and a few other of my friends are sitting around my apartment that I was living in at the time. And we, you know, turn the lights off, like, all right, let's do this again. Turn the lights off, light a candle, Ouija board, you know, and nothing's happening for a while again. But then for the first time ever using that, and I've used it a handful of times at this point, it did move, and it moved to a K, and then to a G, and then to a 7, and then to a 9. Mm-hmm. And we're like, okay, our first impression is, all right, you're like, I'm talking to the other guy across me, you're moving that, knock it off, that's weird, it's, you know, you're being dumb, don't try and scare us, we're trying to do this for real, you know, not pranks and all that type of stuff. So that was my first impression, and that was my thoughts about it for the next half hour after we stopped. I'm like, yeah, he was just moving it. So we're just sitting there watching TV, and at this point our mind had wandered off to the away from, you know, the Ouija board and what we had done. We were talking on to other high school stuff. So my friend Jared is sitting there at like 11:30 at night, and out of nowhere his phone goes off, a notification goes off, he has a text. Mm-hmm. He looks at the text message, and it was this kid that I told you about. And he said, I'm thinking about killing myself. His initials are KG, and his football number was 79.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the, when we heard that, man, I still remember that. I have goosebumps right now just thinking about it. We immediately called him and we're talking to him and all this stuff. And then we talked to our parents, first of all, to see what we should do, and then talk to the school counselor, like all that night, and into the next morning. Mm-hmm. But that was the most impactful experience I've ever had. And it was my second one after doing my first one after the cemetery. So this one was much more on a spiritual level. And we got back on, in fact, we got back on after all this, we had settled down. We got back on the board and we asked if it was a guardian sent here to warn us about that, and said move to yes. And then to this day, it has never moved again for me.
How interesting. I mean, you actually had an experience with the Ouija board that was positive, mm-hmm. that actually, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, yep. obviously he texted, but the thing is, you know, it gave you that much more interesting confirmation of just, you know, obviously there's something serious going on here. I mean, did it take a little bit? I mean, when you get that text from your friend, how quickly did you connect those dots of the initials and the 79? I would think that maybe come a little bit later, but you tell me.
It happened pretty quickly because as soon as Jared read that text out loud to my group of friends, it hit me because I was the one who remembered his football number was 79.
Sure.
And I was like, wait a second, KG 79. And that's when like our hearts sunk. I don't even know how to describe the atmosphere mm-hmm. change at that point, because it just became kind of chaos when that happened in the room. And I never told that kid that story, the KG 79. Mm-hmm. I didn't tell him until about a year later. And when I told him that, he broke down crying.
Wow.
So that was just further confirmation. That is, yep, still to this day, the most powerful thing that's ever happened to me in that sense.
That's really an amazing Ouija board story. I mean, so often we have the super dark ones, and I have very few positive ones that...
exactly.
But sometimes people go, do you ever have a positive one? I'm like, yeah, maybe 1 in 100. That's one that is going to stick with me. It's not to promote using a Ouija board, but it's a very interesting example of the other side of it. Did you have any... I mean, at this point in time, you're in your teen years, did you have any reservations about using a Ouija board or anything like that?
Well, being into, you know, the horror and mm-hmm. scary stuff, I was very aware of the negative consequences, the possibilities that come along with it. Mm-hmm. But again, kind of like in context, I have touched an Ouija board twice in the past 4 years. So mm-hmm. That's not something I do regularly, mm-hmm. certainly. And it's something I've tried to avoid. Because I know the consequences of that. And, from an early age, it's more the curiosity outweighed the possibility of negative side effects from it or consequences.
Sure. Well,
And that's, still, that carries to this day.
That's the age where you feel somewhat invincible too, to everything.
Exactly.
To this day, obviously you have an experience that was positive. Most do not. Mm-hmm. With that being said, is it something that you would ever consider trying or using again in the future?
That's a tough question to answer. You see, we'll probably get into it in a little bit, but I did use it at the Conjuring House mm-hmm. While we were there filming. And it is an apprehension of mine to not want to. I'm not going to say no, that I wouldn't, mm-hmm. but is it something that I'm going to seek out and do in the near future? No, probably not.
Okay. Tell me more about how things progressed for you after, you know, the teen years of doing that sort of stuff to where you got a little more serious about investigating the dead.
Well, we kind of kept doing those things and we didn't have any sort of, you know, super impactful experiences like those first two that I told you about. Until I was about, I want to say for Christmas when I was 18 years old. So this was 5 years ago. I'm 23 right now. My dad got me a night vision camera for Christmas, and I'm like, oh, I know what I'm doing with this. Mm-hmm. And I never had any piece of equipment before other than an Ouija board. I never had even a recorder other than phone audio. I never had a recorder, didn't have a camera, didn't do any of that stuff. Never really knew how to go about it, you know, because I wasn't connected into that paranormal world. I didn't really research paranormal equipment online. I was just kind of doing my own thing. And as soon as I got the night vision camera, I'm like, okay, let's go to a real place, not in my apartment or not in a cemetery where there's all these factors. I want to go to a real, for lack of a better word, famous location. Mm-hmm. And there's one that's about 45 minutes to an hour away from me, the Hinsdale House. I don't know if you're aware of that. Mm-hmm. One.
Yep.
It's about that several Nick times. Groff made famous on Paranormal Lockdown. And that is an hour away from me. And as soon as I got that night vision camera, I got three friends to go along with me. And I'm like, let's go see what we can get. And I booked a public tour up at the Hinsdale House. And April 23rd, 2017, I want to say, was our very first investigation. And that public tour, let's just say from that night on, I was hooked.
Mm-hmm. What occurred on that tour? Was there anything that happened that helped hook you?
Yes. Well, from, you know, it was with a group called Para Expeditions, and they still do these tours to this day at the Hinsdale House and a couple other places. Amazing tour. If anybody's up in Western New York, go check it out. So we get there and we're filming like intros and stuff. We've never done this before. Just created a YouTube page. We had no idea what we were doing. This is kind of shot in the dark, mm-hmm. type of stuff. And the first step I took inside that house, something hit me like an energy that I never felt before, even with my other experiences, where I just was thrown off balance. I was lightheaded. I was like, what the hell is going on here? And that night they had all this equipment we had never used before. We were getting all these intelligent responses. And I remember middle of the night, they split the groups up. There was about 11 of us total in this house. And we split the groups up. I was upstairs and with my friends and one of the tour guides, and the rest were downstairs. And we had some crazy responses with a child there that has been like a history of the property, did die in that house on property. And we go downstairs, you know, kind of joking, like, whoa, that was awesome, that was so cool. And the vibe on the first floor was just so off that it stunned everybody from the top floor in silence, because they were all, the rest of the group that was downstairs was all gathered around, and they were doing, I don't remember what the thing was, but they were trying to help a spirit move on, was the gist of what they were doing. And they were saying these prayers, and the energy was so weird, and everybody was emotional downstairs, physically crying, I remember. And it was that energy, that moment on, I was like, whoa, this is so crazy. This is what I'm gonna do now. Mm-hmm. It was that night that kind of hooked me.
Oh, that's understandable. So you got hooked on that through that experience, and obviously you continued on further. What was it like? What were some of the things you started to go into in more of a private way rather than, you know, those moments of finding that with a group or a public type of setting? What was your thought? Was your goal then, okay, you're hooked on this, but is the goal for you to just investigate, to have the experiences for yourself? Or is there a goal to help others? I mean, what did you want to do after, you know, kind of feeling, okay, I'm hooked on this? What direction did you want to go?
So from that night at the Hinsdale House, we did another public at the Randolph County Infirmary down in Indiana. Mm-hmm. And it was with Ghost Hunts USA. And we made some good connections with people there, friends, and who are now friends of mine, who come, one of them's a psychic medium named Beth. She comes in to play big time at the Conjuring House. So mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll get into that. And we just had a really good time. Me and Alex, my co-founder of my group, had this really, really strong personal connection with the spirit who said his name was Vince up on the second floor jail cell. And that was another thing. That was the first like true connection I've ever felt like that. So from there, we were planning on doing another public when Beth from Ghost Hunts USA messaged me out of the blue one day and said, hey, Ghost Hunts USA has an event scheduled at Randolph County, but we can't really do it. Do you guys want it on a discount for 48 hours? It's mm-hmm. all yours. We'll leave the key for you. We trust you. Go on. If you want it, go ahead. And we snatched that offer up in a heartbeat. And from there, I guess really the goal was more, it stemmed from the curiosity that we all felt. And there's a residual or a residential case that we took on after that, that kind of made us want to help spirits who we feel are trapped here move on the same way the Hinsdale House. And so we have kind of several different goals. The main one is we just love doing it, and we love, you know, going out and having these experiences and filming them and, you know, trying to build connections with these spirits. And then also, particularly probably later on when we're completely more comfortable with it, because we're all, you know, only 23 still, to be mm-hmm. able to help people. So just learn yeah. through experience and then take what we learn from there and move forward wherever we feel it takes us.
And everybody's got to start somewhere. And that's, it's kind of interesting to talk to you from someone who's, you know, you're younger, you're kind of getting into this, you know, in the first couple of years. A lot of the folks that we talk to on the show have been in this for quite some time. Mm-hmm. But it's always just interesting to hear the perspective of someone who's new and getting into it. You know, may not seem new to you, but, you know, in terms of...
Right. Exactly. Yeah, no, we're still young, but we're rookies still.
For someone who's been here for 20-some, you know, years or something like that, it's, you know, that's obviously... the early years and a lot of things that that you learn along the way. When you are beginning this and you have residential investigations and you have an interest in doing that, I mean, what how do you set the expectations of the people that are contacting you? Do you and do you feel qualified to go into something like that at a residential type level with, you know, not having much experience? But again, everyone has to start somewhere.
Exactly. Well, you know, when you go to one of those big name places, it's hard to walk in with any sort of skepticism because mm-hmm. you've just heard so much about that particular place. But when you go to a residential, when somebody tells me their ghost story, something that's happening to them right now, and I need to come check it out and all this stuff, and they hear that that's, you know, something I do, I'm very, very skeptical. And I think that is the best way to approach it.
I'm sure.
Now, if I go into a location that I feel is something's very wrong there, and a residential house is very wrong, mm-hmm. I am very aware that in that circumstance, I'm way over my head. So, but the best I can do is that I've gotten enough resources and gained enough connections with people through this field that I know who to reach out to for help. Mm-hmm. So I am confident when I go into places like that, that I know who to reach out to in that case. But for me to do that personally, no, I don't touch that. Anything I feel like is over my head, I'm not going to, you know,
sure.
try and step in and play hero or anything like that. So, well, yeah.
It's a path that makes sense because I think many people would just try and, you know, tackle it themselves. But you want to bring someone else in who can help and then maybe learn from them as you
exactly.
go through that. Well, that makes sense. Tell me, I want to get into the visit to the Conjuring House, but what was your knowledge of the Conjuring? Obviously, there's the movie. You know, what was your thought process about trying to reach out and trying to get some time in the Conjuring House?
So when, obviously, the Conjuring is one of my all-time favorite horror movies, so I knew so much about the Hollywood side of the story.
Sure.
And then I think it was, what was it, a year ago or 2 years ago, Ghost Adventures did their Halloween episode at the Conjuring House. Mm-hmm. And it was at that very moment I started looking into it. Okay, there's these new owners of the Conjuring House. They are paranormal investigators, and they are opening it up for teams to come in. I just took a shot in the dark. I was searching all over for their Facebook page, and I couldn't find it because it wasn't named the Conjuring House or anything like that. It was the farm on Round Top Road is mm-hmm. their Facebook. And when I finally found that, I found the number and I called, and I was able to get in very quickly. January of 2020 is when we investigated, and we were actually the first group to stay multiple nights in that house. Up until us, everybody had done one night, and we were the first to do multiple. And that's when I started looking into the real Perrin family's story, mm-hmm. Through whether it be her book, Andrea Perrin's book, House of Darkness, House of Light, or, you know, documentaries of investigators that have been there on YouTube and things like that. So that's when I really started to learn the true story of the Perrin family in that house. And like I said before, it's very hard to walk into a location like that with skepticism, but we tried our best to do so, not knowing what's there now, reading about what was there in the 70s, but we're not sure what's there now. And honestly, that investigation ended up being, I would say, our craziest.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Nolan. In part two, does the spirit of a once living woman named Bathsheba Sherman still linger in the Conjuring House? Does Nolan believe multiple entities are haunting that location? How did Nolan's investigation at that location take a twisted turn? And is there a danger when opening a haunted location for anyone to investigate it? Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.